sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our day if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Hey, welcome to the latest edition of the Export Finance Podcast. I'm again joined here by all four of the four musketeers. I don't know, three musketeers and D'Artagnan. Yeah, we'll go with that. Yes. Yeah, so the issue this week is moving on from what we covered in terms of the distribution in the last podcast is on capital markets and engagement with investors and non-traditional. Sort of sources of liquidity, and so Gabby, I'll start with you. Just asking, you know, who are these investors, these mythical beasts that are now looking to buy export finance?
These are real cash investors. They are pension funds, the life insurance companies, and I think they're driven by looking for high quality alternative asset class that gives them yield. And they are attracted to this asset because the illiquidity of these assets, they see that they get a pickup in that yield. So they're very much driven by making sure that there's no currency mismatch. So if you've got a dollar asset, you're going to be looking for dollar investors based in the US. And, you know, the same if it's sterling, the same if it's in South African rand. You know, you need to go to South Africa and sell the asset to those fixed income investors there. And, you know, as I was saying in the previous podcast, they are moving away, in my opinion, away from having a fixed income rated bond into now coming in as a lender of record in a loan facility.
I mean, it's possible because they have such huge pots of cash to spend. For a small amount of that, and when I say a small amount of that, that small amount could be $10, $15, $20 billion. They can afford to have some illiquid assets that are yielding higher than, in the classic cases, the, you know, US Exim and US Treasuries, and they've got piles of US Treasuries, very low yielding, particularly over the last few years. US Exim, they can have a significant pickup, although it is illiquid, it is structured slightly, it's amortizing, so there are features to it that aren't attractive, which is why it'll never get to be as massive as the you know the debt capital markets could be. So, yeah, I see exactly the same types of investors, asset managers. I mean, and this is not something that's new either. We've all been talking to institutional investors for a good 15 years. It's now becoming more needed in the market. So the banks, as we said last time, the banks that had this massive hold requirement internally to, you know, to build up their asset portfolios, that has now changed. So you've got the old distribution banks together with the traditional export credit banks all now trying to go into the capital markets, and hence why you also get individual investors but also increased appetite to try and form vehicle companies that can have a more generic product and offer to the capital markets.
Yep. I'm a bit a stickler on terminology. I don't see this as being a capital markets issuance anymore. I think the market's moved on. I just think this is non-bank investors. I don't think these assets need to be rated. I don't think they need to be repackaged anymore. You know, these guys will just come in and a great example of that is where JP Morgan on the Transnet deal in South Africa were an arranger, but actually they never lent. It went straight into, they were the ones who sought a pension fund as an investor, as the lender of record. And that I thought was quite interesting. It just moved it straight to, I'm a financial intermediary. And I see that market moving, in my opinion.
I still think there's reticence in the institutional investor market. You know, yes, there are institutional investors that buy assets in loan format. Absolutely, there are. But in the context of the whole market, it's a very, very small percentage who are doing that.
Yes, because the amount that is available for them, because the pricing of these assets as a class is still undertaken by banks at a rate which is lower than the fixed income investors will.
The volume. Can I just make a comment on that, though? I think in the export finance world, the institutional investors coming into export finance deals in loan format is probably quite a high proportion of those deals being done with institutional investors, because you've got the pure capital markets at issuance, you know, aircraft deals essentially, and then you've got, in order to generate notes in a loan format, you're talking really about repack, or you're talking about transactions which draw down so quickly they can go straight into a capital markets funding, and there aren't really very many of those. And so a lot of deals still are getting done in loan format with institutional investors as buyers. I think the, you know, again, we're in a transition market. There's huge interest from institutional investors in all forms of trade asset classes at the moment. And they've realised that banks can't hold all this paper. And I mean short-term trade as well as export finance. There are securitisations being done in short-term trade finance for the first time. We did one really quite recently, a large one as well, in order to de-risk part of the short-term trade book. And one of the key facilitators in this process is having data around what happens when things go wrong.
Yeah.
And that is starting to be built on a sort of purposeful, intentional basis so that institutional investors can be accessed more easily. They started a little bit earlier on the short-term side, and we're starting to do that now on the medium and long-term side as well. And I'm thinking about the ICC with their data register on short-term assets, which started earlier than it did for medium-long-term. The medium and long-term side is now building up a body of evidence, which the institutional investors need when they go to justify the positions they're taking.
Will they be, I mean, I can see sort of the initiative. I mean, I guess the initiative for behind ICC was also advocacy relating to regulation, at least in its initial concept. Would, I mean, if were I to be an investor, would I be a little bit nervous that the ICC register is something that is maintained by the banks? The banks choose what kind of gets put in and don't really share that too widely at the moment.
But that's where the information has to come from, ultimately, I think, at this point in time. Where else is it going to originate from? So, you know, it is a question of education, getting that information out there into the domain, public domain, so that, you know, these investors can analyse what is actually happening and take the comfort that they need to, you know, make those decisions.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty good exercise, Dan. You know, the process that the advisors to the ICC are going through in order to draw in that data are going through a really fairly involved process. Everything goes in. It's anonymized, if that's a word, so that the actual underlying asset can't be associated with an underlying client. And everything has to go in. Defaults the lot. Because otherwise, you're right, you know, it's going to be flawed data. But certainly my experience is that that's a very thorough process, and I'm happy to believe in the data that's coming out the other end.
You just raised, I remember having a discussion with another banker in another institution who was like us, doing a huge amounts of selling these assets. And the question we debated was about operational risk. Who was actually taking the operational risk? What would happen if we had sold an asset to a fixed income investor through our sales desk, and then the guarantee got flipped because the bank had done an operational error? Who would be taking that risk? And we both agreed it would be back with the bank. Because you can imagine your sales desk saying to the export finance team, I don't care what's in the documentation, all right? Our investors bought this based on the sovereign guarantee of X. Something's gone wrong here. You need to buy this back. And so therefore, it's going to be interesting to see how the institutional investors will behave if something goes wrong. And nothing has gone wrong, as far as I am aware, in terms of assets that have been sold to them. But if something does start to kick back, it'd be interesting to see what the knock-on effect will be for the banks and how other institutional investors will look at this as an asset class going forward.
I guess the other question on that, in terms of the obligation, is if there is an obligation, implicit or otherwise, then what does that mean in terms of Basel compliance and sort of getting things off balance sheet?
Leverage ratio, exactly. irrespective of what the documentation will have, because the banks will be saying, look, this institutional investor, I sell them a whole array of asset class. I don't want to have this relationship upset because of this small ECA transaction.
Well, that's one of the reasons why the institutional investors have not mopped up more of this. That's one of the reasons. The educational process you have to go through to help them understand that either they are or they're not taking this risk, whichever way it's gone, is challenging. Mm. And which is why, coming back to something I nearly talked about, programs, I think programmatic issuance, where you're divorced more, where the loan's sold into a program and then that program issues notes, I still believe is the long-term future of this business. I really do. I think that's the way it will go, mainly because of things like Basel III coming through, where it's going to be impossible for banks to hold huge inventories of ECA assets.
Is there, and I suppose maybe I was driving at this with some of the ICC, because it's the ICC Banking Commission trade register. It is a bank. And, just looking at this room, you're all very familiar with each other. You've worked with each other. Is there a danger of an us and them scenario? There's investors, who are putting money in. You guys know each other, know how it's worked, and then you have a register that's administered by the banks. The banks put it in. Does export finance need to get a little bit more independent and get more sort of engagement with investors if it really wants to sort of distribute to that market in the greater levels?
Yeah, I would agree with that completely, but I think you've got to start somewhere, and the industry's kind of starting, and the understanding of the product by the institutional investors is just at its infancy. Some institutional investors understand it very well, I would say, others less so. But I take your point that if this is going to work as a model and a vision for the industry going forward, it needs to be much more closely aligned, and we need to get better at understanding how these investors would like to see the loans presented or the notes presented or the assets presented, and they in turn should get a little bit better at understanding the idiosyncrasies of some of the ECAs and the idiosyncrasies of those ECAs that we work with. It's at the start of that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I suppose a follow-up question on that would be, and one of the things we discussed last time was, if you're now finding a wider variety of people that you are distributing to, sort of banks, investors, other sort of non-traditional players, who's best placed to play that role of distributing those assets? Is it an export finance person? Is it someone elsewhere in the bank that has less experience on the ECA product?
There's two elements to that. I think there is who would have the knowledge as to who in the market will buy that asset intra-bank. Then I think it's the export finance teams that will know each, as we all know each other, we know which bank will have what appetite for what sector and what geography. Mm. But in reality, and this took me years to learn, in reality, that's great in terms of the speed and efficiency of getting rid of an asset. But it doesn't help you when you then are internally trying to get a huge underwrite. Mm. Because what banks need is you need someone in the syndications desk who has had the experience, the knowledge and understanding as to what can be distributed, because their voice at the table when you want an underwrite is going to be 10 times louder than any of our voices, because we will be viewed internally as having a vested interest to do that underwrite. So I think there's an element of export finance teams, if they're in the distribution model, they need to be working very closely with their syndication desk, educating them as to who they are, i.e. the end investors, and then getting them more comfortable that there is this market liquidity for that.
That's a big change I've noticed in the last 5 to 10 years, is the fact that all export credit largely, 15, 10 years ago, was distributed by the likes of us to our export credit colleagues in the market. And then if you're going to sell into the capital markets or the institutional investors, you need to have people who understand those investors and what those investors' requirements are. And if you've got someone like us doing that, you have to do it in tandem. And what's happened is you've had a big shift to distribution teams being responsible for the distribution of ECA assets, whereas it would never want... They didn't understand those assets, so they couldn't sell them. They understood what the investors wanted, so that education has filtered across. Now, many, many banks... I mean, I can think of a bank that I visited this week in Dubai, where I saw the export credit team with the distribution team, because that was how they set up their model to work. You know, they work with their distribution teams from the outset. So the distribution teams are learning about the product as well. Mm. I think it also helps the ECA teams to learn about the investors.
And we've cross-fertilised into our distribution team. We've put specific ECA people into our distribution team, so they have the independence from the front office ECA unit, but they are there with the relevant knowledge to make sure that the discussions with the investors are in line with what the requirements of the product. So, and that has worked quite well.
Okay. Is it the same at Deutsche Bank as well, or is it?
It's absolutely the same. I think in a funny sort of way, we've tried to get the best of both worlds, because we have a dedicated arm's length distribution team which just sells trade assets. And they do short-term trade, they do medium and long-term trade, and they also do structured commodity trade finance. So they understand the trade asset class very, very well, but they are not the guys doing the deals. They are genuinely arm's length. So when it comes to writing a highly confident statement on an underwriting or syndication, they can do it. It's the only voice. It's not only a 10 times louder, it is the only voice that credit will listen to when it comes to underwriting a transaction. And so really, really important. However, once we're switching to the non-bank investor base, there's an army of people in Deutsche doing this. And either we take the decision we're going to, you know, replicate that and rebuild it, which is going to take a lot of time, or we just say, okay, let's just go straight to these guys. They know what they're doing. They can sell this.
And they know their investors, and they know what appetite those investors will have and when.
Yes.
That's the key aspect, you know. Mm. They track the portfolio that those investors have got. They know what assets they've got and when those assets mature. So they'll say, okay, in 6 months' time, my client will have capacity to take this type of asset because their existing portfolio will mature. And that knowledge and understanding enables you to forward sell these assets. And that I think, is a very interesting development for the market as a whole.
Forward sell, and that timing issue is another of the big challenges we have, which is the vagaries of export finance transactions. When will it come to market? Yep. And we've all been victim of this. You can have deals which drift and take much longer to deliver. And generally what our sales guys want who are selling to institutional investors are they want an asset that's available right now. And they're not very good at thinking about an asset that's going to be available in 6 months or
and you could be pitching 9 months, you know, you may 9 months later is the issuance or whatever, but you need to bid and win that on a certain pricing, certain assumptions at the outset. So, and that is that time, managing that time period, I think, is the key issue going forward. And that's why moving into a more sort of structured, you know, either a vehicle approach or whatever, is perhaps something that will give you know, give some of the comfort and alleviate some of those concerns by having more sort of formalised channels by which you can do this.
That's where the money is. That's where the real sophistication goes, where you've got someone who understands what's happening in the future, has had the experience in terms of where the pricing is, has the voice at the table to say, look, if we warehouse this facility and we get this as a yield on this asset today, but in 6 months' time we can sell that asset at something else. That's the clever play that banks can do in this
asset. Big market risk, though, in that.
What?
Especially volatility. You should see how markets have moved.
What, in the last 6 years? I don't see any volatility. I mean, you know,
okay.
in the last 6 years on CDS pricing for sovereigns post the way that these has priced in the bank market?
I think ECA assets have been pretty volatile.
I think...
Drawn?
I agree with both of you, but I make the observation that you don't need much volatility on a 10 or 12 or 13 or 14-year asset for there to be a big swing in the P&L. And it can only be 10, 20, 30 basis points on a 10-year running transaction to make the difference between being in the black or being quite heavily in the red. Mm-hmm. So it is tricky, but I agree with you. That's going to be the role of the banks going forward. It's that warehousing and intermediation will handle this during drawdown, and then you take care of it.
That's what banks are for, though. I mean, warehousing assets like this on a short-term basis is what banks, obviously, that's the role they should be playing.
Should be playing,
yeah.
But they don't.
Not yet, but they will.
They will. Yeah.
And I guess a natural move on. I remember sort of being at a conference a couple of years ago, and someone was talking about what type of people they want coming into the trade business, and it was people with, which was coming out, this was short-term trade, but it was people with experience of DCM and securitization, particularly. This sort of idea of asset pooling, and you know, sort of Simon, you mentioned securitization earlier. Yes, there's been trade maps, which I think, as you know, on the short term side, has had a relatively patchy history. But is this sort of something that's going to develop, this idea of pooling assets, and actually, if it's done, does it then have to be multi bank? I think for it to be sort of,
I think multi bank is the way to go.
It's critical mass, deal flow, volumes, certainty.
Yep.
Getting the strong names together, I think, will be the way forward on this.
In that, there have been medium-term programs. I mean, GovCo was a very, very successful program for many, many years. Obviously funded very short in the CP market, but it was a program that did work to fund medium-term assets. For a couple of years, SovRisk obviously worked. And I think that is the way that is to get the institute. That's why I mentioned earlier about to have a program that has recognised volume and recognised name for the asset class, and you're only going to get that with at least, I don't know, you'd need at least four or five banks, I think, to get the volumes. You need banks who are represented in different geographies to get a spread of business, because some geographies come, you know, Middle East is strong one day and the Latin America is strong the next. So you need a lot of things to come together.
It's not just creating volume, it's also demonstrating to the regulators that you don't have any sort of individual control, that this is sufficiently diluted across a number of institutions, that it's not a Deutsche Bank vehicle or a TD vehicle.
Because it comes back on balance sheet.
Because it only comes, and I have to say, you know, we talk about the complexities of the export finance world, the complexities of the securitization world are equally, if not much more, complex. And not just that, but it's in flux as well, changing very, very quickly. And so Volcker rule, bail in, step in. There's, you know, it gets harder and harder to genuinely get things off the balance sheet.
The AAA rated securitization vehicles died with the crisis.
And I believe that this is noise, because in reality, if the asset is a good asset and you can sell it, you just do a clean sale. And trade business, you know, its DNA is about selling assets and trading assets.
Mm.
And I don't think we should be, you know, when we look at practitioners in the market, I don't think we should be trying to overcomplicate this. This is good quality assets. You know, ICC know that, the ECAs know that, and the investors know that. If you've priced this well, you can sell this tomorrow. The challenge, I think, for banks is where they haven't priced it well and they're holding on to this asset. All of these assets can be distributed. There is no shortage of liquidity.
No. It's the question. At the right price.
At the right price, right? And so if it's priced right, you've sold it tomorrow. If you sold it tomorrow as a clean sell, gone. End of story. You know, you don't have the problem of leverage. You don't have the question about whether this comes back onto your balance sheet if this and this happens. You don't have the problems with dealing with the regulators. You've sold it.
And to do that, you need to have a mentality of pricing deals for sale. And that's what we've been discussing, actually, isn't it?
Yep. Mark to market.
Yeah.
So that being the case, is there likely in the next 5 years to be a significant pricing arbitrage in export finance? Does there have to be, right? You know, does the prices have to rise quite a lot are they that underpriced? If you're trying to go through this whole process to sell them to a new group, I mean, is it just too cheap?
Absolutely right, but I've been wrong on this for the last 2.5 years, because I've been saying pricing's going to go up in export finance and it just stubbornly hasn't. And it's very frustrating, I think, for all of us. And the reason it hasn't is because the market is still very fragmented. As we've been discussing, there's still lots of liquidity available. But that logic that the market does have to go up because banks' balance sheets are getting more expensive is still true. And it's a question of how quickly we get there, I think.
I mean, the ECB is still printing money. You know, that liquidity is not going to disappear anytime soon. You've got the whole of Europe going through depression or whatever you want to call it at the moment. And you know, the long-term forecasts here in the UK have gone south this week as well. And while that's happening, interest rates don't seem to be going anywhere and cash is being printed. So liquidity is not disappearing. And it's kind of counterintuitive because you've got that. And then on the other side with the banks, you've got the increased regulation, which tells you that pricing needs to go up.
Yep.
Yes.
Exactly.
So you've got a market that's
torn between the two.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine it'll happen when the management of banks starts saying you can't price this anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's the leverage ratio more than anything else. I think that there are banks who are forced to reduce their total leverage, and so therefore, we talked about this in the previous podcast, that you know, these long dated assets that yield high quality, that yield a low amount, is challenging in terms of the leverage ratio. But there are also other banks who are underlent, saying, you know, come to me, I've got appetite and balance sheet, here's my checkbook, this is my price. They don't have to do a lot of structuring and arranging, although some of them are, but they're literally just saying, I've got balance sheet and I want to book and hold these assets on a long-term basis.
So what one point, Simon, you did raise, well, you sort of talked about before, is the interest rate environment. How competitive is our export finance assets to the investor community if there's a significant change in interest rates?
Mm.
Don't know.
Yeah,
crystal ball.
If I knew that. Yeah. But certainly that's what's caused one of the factors that has assisted the increased appetite of institutional investors for US EXIM assets has been the historically low interest rates in the US, with US Treasuries yielding zip, and therefore they've had to look for yield, and the way they've got that yield is by taking the slightly different risk of US EXIM versus US government. Luckily it's deemed to be about the same risk, but the yield is quite significantly above. So the interest rate environment is a factor that gets taken into account. As interest rates rise, I mean, what we did see was when rates went up last year, there was a less of a move into the capital markets for US EXIM paper. But that also coincided with the general lack of US EXIM paper as well. But I mean, talking to people that I know that understand the institutional investor market in the US, they don't believe there's infinite investor base there for US EXIM. You know, deals that have been done tend to have been done generally on a $75 to $150 million basis per deal. Bigger deals have been done. I mean, the $400-500 million deals have been done.
Here's one about to get done now.
Sorry, that's a cash investor calling.
But the absolute and the number of investors, I mean, the number of investors who bought US EXIM bonds isn't hundreds. It's not hundreds. So I think we'll see when US EXIM comes back. Hopefully it will come back. I think there has to be more of those deals in the future going into the capital market. So if Boeing business comes back for US EXIM in a big way, and it's not going to come back in a huge way yet because you've got fuel prices very low, airlines are not stressed at the moment, but the oil price will go up, and fuel costs will go up for airlines, and there will be stress. And I don't think at that time, that's going to be 2017, 2018, getting very close to Basel III kicking in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
My personal view is that there will be more deals into the capital markets at that time, particularly on the Boeing US EXIM side.
Mm. Okay. And sorry, you're going to say something?
I was just going to say that the theory is that really the same demand should exist for these assets, even in a higher interest rate environment, because the yield on export finance assets also rises when interest rates go up. Most of these deals are LIBOR plus X,
mm-hmm.
Which means that the yield on those will go up too. But the practice suggests that when rates rise, people are less inclined to do the hard work to understand the asset, to look into other things, just easier to do.
And there are imperfections in the market, as we discussed earlier, imperfections in the market, because those imperfections include banks who are over liquid, who compete for those assets as well. Yeah. So it's not a perfect market at all.
And don't forget the construct of the SIR rate. You know, with the way that the SIR rate is calculated, there are times when that becomes very, very attractive. And that will actually crowd out the fixed income market, because buyers will be saying, this is the rate I will want to do. And also the export credit agencies will be very interested in making sure that their exporters get the best rate. And there's been a lot of behaviour in the past, and I don't know whether it's still true today, but it's been behaviour in the past where the export credit agencies have been very cognizant of what the fixed income investors are buying that asset for and what yield, and may actually stop or change the issuance of a particular note because they didn't want the benchmark to be of a particular level. And so the agencies, and we haven't talked about this yet, the agencies are looking at where this market is, because they're not really that bothered as to whether the funding comes from bank, fixed income, or from themselves. They just want to make sure that their exporters get the best deal. So I think there's checks and balances as this market changes. So if interest rates...
Which ECAs are most proactively sort of working in this area? Which have been most successful and which have been least successful?
I think that, you know, when I was saying what I was saying, I was thinking more of US exit in terms of, you know, the process and order that you had to go through doing a capital market issuance. And they would be... managing the roadshow and the issuance of paper, and be very aware as to what the price would be.
I think obviously UKEF has done an enormous amount over the last 3 years to bring itself to the table as well, in the changes they've made to replicate what US Exim have done.
I tell you where this question becomes, it's a very interesting question, where this becomes particularly acute is with OECD Cat 1 borrowers, because pricing has to match roughly the market. And the more the lender, institutional investor, takes out of the deal, the less the ECA can, because they have to set their premium at a level, which means the deal still looks right compared to commercial lending in the free market, in the unsecured market. So we've been involved in transactions where there becomes a fair amount of tension between the bank, the lender, and in this case an institutional investor, and the ECA, in terms of recognising that there's a finite return on that transaction available, and the more that's paid away to the institutional investor, the less the ECA can charge in premium. Yeah. And there it becomes very, very much a point of focus.
Actually, it's acutely focused, because the no one wants to be questioned as to whether you're breaching state aid rules. And so on that point, Simon, I've seen it where the premium that's being charged has been recalculated to make sure everything fits.
Everything fits,
And so it does become quite a complex and circular pricing methodology.
Yeah.
And I think for Category 1, it's a real issue.
So here's an idea. Are those ECAs which currently have either direct lending facilities available or treasuries, national treasuries, which have set up entities to be lenders under export finance, are those ECAs slowing the pace of change towards a capital market model by, again, bringing more liquidity into the market?
A rhetorical question, or what do you believe, Simon?
Well, if you look at the case of UKEF, yeah, absolutely. You know, as coming back to Gabby's point about the SIR rates, you know, it's been a fantastic run for them in terms of being able to access a cheap fixed rate, highly competitive. So it must have crowded out other forms of financing. I'm sure that's the case.
It was a rhetorical question, and in a funny sort of way, it is hampering it, because we all recognise that for this to become a successful asset class, you need to have volume. And to the extent you're having direct lenders reducing that volume, then it's crowding out not just banks volume. and, you know, but
the capital markets.
It's not only volume, it's also a certain level of similarity amongst the guarantees and what the agencies actually offer, because it's a very fragmented asset class at the moment.
Yes.
And you have to remember why we're here. At the end of the day, each ECA has its own national interest at heart. So if a particular country wants to provide a direct lending program or a funding source for banks to make sure its exports are successful, it will do so. And that does exactly your point. It does work against a broader commercial market.
And don't get me wrong, it was exactly the right thing to do because the market's not yet
failed.
Ready.
Yeah. It
the market did fail. Yeah. So these direct lending schemes have been essential, very, very important. They were needed. And, I commend the agencies that put them in place as quickly as they did. But now, as we transition away, definitely that's kind of acting as a little bit of an anchor to a system, a lending liquidity system that is hampering the move towards capital markets. Unintentionally, probably.
Yeah, but
and that's okay.
But I think on balance, I would prefer that to be there than not, as it is at the moment. It's solved a number of issues on a number of transactions for us over the last few years. So
and for us. So, no.
I see it very much as a positive.
Yeah, I see it as, and I agree with you both in terms of it is a positive. But the reasons it's a positive is more about the SIR rate itself.
It's competitive.
It's a very competitive rate. And I don't see the SIR rate as being a crowding out from the fixed income market or from the bank market, because both of those markets cannot offer the features and benefits that SIR provides. And I think that is the main driver as to why these agencies are providing SIR.
But if that wasn't there, though, Gabby, then would we be doing more capital? Would there be the potential for more deals to be going down the capital market route?
Yeah,
potentially.
Yeah. Yeah. But not. But if there's one agency out there somewhere around the world that's offering the SIR rate,
yeah,
the buyers will go, this is where I want. I want the SIR rate and I'll buy goods and services from that country. So the other export credit agencies are, in my opinion, having to react to that and come up with their own SIR arrangements.
Okay, well, I feel, in conclusion, so there's a move in the direction, I guess, to a kind of at least an increasingly diversified form of distribution that will involve capital markets, investors, and whatever else. But it sounds like you guys might have some work to do, maybe before it's all there. But well, thank you very much. And the next time I'll see all of you will be in Rome in a few weeks. And see you next time. Thank you.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side, keep on the sunny side of life.